Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Good but not good enough. That was the jobs report today. Also, how the U.S. economy gets from here to Election Day. And hey, you got a job opening? Hire a vet, will you? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Balance your life with dollar signs. Tune into Marketplace Money this weekend for a look at the issues affecting your wallet. Whether it's investing, renting an apartment, or sending your kid off to college, we'll help you navigate.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It's Friday today, the 7th of October. Good to have you with us. So we got what might best be described as a perfectly okay report out of the Labor Department this morning. The number of jobs in the American economy increased by 103,000 last month. There are some statistical twists and turns, but that's a solid headline number. The unemployment rate is stuck, as you might have heard, at 9.1%. Now, I want you to forget all that. Just wash it out of your mind. Because really, in something as big as the American economy, it's not the month-to-month ups and downs you got to worry about. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman has our long-term forecast.
Now that we added more than 100,000 jobs in September, we might be tempted to cue the happy music. Not so fast, says economist Kevin Hassett at the American Enterprise Institute.
Right now, this is about as good as it gets.
Hassett thinks we'll plateau around 100,000 new jobs a month for the foreseeable future, meaning the unemployment rate won't budge and the 6 million long-term unemployed won't get back on the job, says Harvard economist Lawrence Katz.
The modest job growth that we have seen is just about what you need to keep up with population growth. It's not enough to bring people back to work.
And Kevin Hassett says we shouldn't really be surprised because this has been no ordinary recession.
No, we have to compare ourselves really to the Great Depression. It's the last time that we've had this big a financial crisis at the onset of a recession.
Now, the recent recessions in the 1990s and 2000s also had pretty much jobless recoveries, but they didn't also come with a collapse of global finance and waves of consumer and business panic, so they weren't nearly as long or deep.
In the longer recession, you tend to see cyclical unemployment become structural unemployment because people who haven't had a job for a while have a really hard time getting one again.
Many economists now predict we could still have 8% unemployment in 2018 and that many of today's long-term unemployed will simply have stopped looking for good by then. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
It's funny, I didn't know Let the Good Times Roll was the happy music, but, you know, Mitchell's been here for a while, so maybe he knows. There is an undeniably political side to the management of the American economy, the labor market side, to be precise. The fortunes of anybody who's in a position to decide things in Washington, of either party, seems to hang in the balance. Catch is, managing the American economy? Yeah, that's way easier said than done. So we've called Stan Colander to get some insights. He's a longtime federal budget guy, currently a partner at Corvus Communications in Washington. Stan, it's good to talk to you again.
Nice to be here, as always.
So I have this theory, and I'd be curious to get your take, that the economy we have today is the economy we're going to have come Election Day. Agree or disagree?
Well, the one thing we can be relatively certain is that the efforts to fix the economy that have been taken so far are the only ones we're going to see that Congress and the president aren't really going to be able to agree on much between now and the election. And so the economy is pretty much on its own. It will go up, it will go down, but it's not going to be helped much from Washington.
Let's say, just for the sake of argument, that the White House and Democrats in the Senate and Republicans in the House and everybody can get together and agree on something. I don't even care what it is. Is there enough time between now and Election Day for anything to happen, given the intractable beast that is the American economy?
Oh, no, absolutely.
Really?
Look, if you're talking about, quote, shovel-ready, unquote, projects, that is, you know, building big infrastructure things, the answer is certainly not. But if you're talking about quick turnaround kind of spending, you know, insulation for schools or whatever, yeah, certainly they can do that, and tax cuts can be implemented relatively quickly. In addition, Kai, remember that there are two ways that the government would be boosted. One would be the actual change in public policy, tax cuts or spending increases. The second would be people feeling a little bit better about life and because of those things, and therefore be willing to spend their own money in advance of those things actually happening.
One likes to assume that everybody's interests in Washington are aligned. Do you buy that?
Well, I was going to say you're not that naive, are you?
It's one of those questions you got to pose.
Yeah, and the answer is absolutely positively not. This is not like it used to be in Washington. And by used to be, I mean 20, 30 years ago, where people would fight like hell during the campaign but come together to try to do things and compromise. Compromise as a word has now become the equivalent of a four-letter word in Washington. So, at this point, there are a lot of people just pointing at the election and saying, we don't want to do anything to make the economy better so Barack Obama can take credit for it. And there are other folks who are saying, all right, if that's what they want, let's let them have it and they'll be blamed. And you know what? The polls show both of those things may be right.
Riddle me this, though, Stan. What are we to do come the day after Election Day if partisanship is so ingrained?
Well, first of all, you got to tell me what's going to happen on Election Day. I mean, the kind of wave elections we've had, up till now of the last two elections may happen again. And I've heard from several big-name elections analysts that we could see the biggest turning out of incumbents that we've had maybe ever in American history, that maybe 125 to 150 people in the House could lose their seats. The only question is we don't know which ones and which parties they're going to come from. But come January, when the new Congress gets sworn in, there could be a wholesale change in what we're doing. The big question, Kai, is can we, any of us wait that long?
Stan Collender at Corvus Communications in Washington. He writes a column for Roll Call. It's a newspaper on Capitol Hill called Fiscal Fitness. Stan, thanks a lot.
My pleasure.
All right, enough about us. What about them? There are big meetings in Europe this weekend. It's the usual. You can figure it out. Debt, Greece, bailout, all that stuff. Latest word from the continent is that they're thinking it's time for their own version of the TARP, our $700 billion bailout that at least put a floor under our financial panic back then. $700 billion was a whole lot of money. Still is, actually. But get a load of the rumors from Europe. $2.5 to $5 trillion. Where'd they get the numbers? From New York Marketplace's Heidi Moore has the story.
How do you figure out the size of a bailout? It's kind of like planning a decisive military victory.
Shock and awe. This is what I would like to refer to as the Colin Powell shock and awe doctrine of bailouts.
Those were the answers I heard from Tony Fratto and John Douglas. They're both veterans of financial panics. Fratto worked with Treasury Secretary Hank Paulson in 2008. Douglas was the general counsel of the FDIC in the savings and loan crisis of the late 80s. Douglas says regulators want to flood the banks with enough money to leave no doubt that they're open for business.
It's intended to get the marketplace to relax so that they're comfortable dealing with these institutions on a daily basis.
So the government essentially makes up the size of the bailout. Fratto explains there is no other way to do it.
When that panic sets in, there's no mathematical model that can adequately estimate what those losses might be. It just doesn't exist, and that's where you get these wild estimates.
Even so, 2 to 4 trillion euros for Europe? That's at least four times as big as the size of the U.S. bailout. Yes, their banks are much bigger than ours, but Fratto says he's skeptical of the number.
I don't know how they're possibly going to raise that amount of money.
If it's any comfort, Europe may not need to draw down every last trillion. In the U.S., we had lots of TARP money left over. In New York, I'm Heidi Moore for Marketplace.
Traders went searching today, trying to find something to pin their hopes on, either up or down. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Frustrations seem to be the through line this week. What with Occupy Wall Street, more delays in Europe, and the status quo in Washington that Stan Collender and I were just talking about. So that is where we're going to start our weekly wrap of Wall Street and beyond on this Friday. Fortune Magazine's Lee Gallagher and Felix Salmon from Reuters are gathered together in our cozy little studios in New York. Hey, guys.
Hi, Kai.
Hi, Kai. It's very cozy.
It is very cozy. I know. I've been there. So listen, let's start with Occupy Wall Street, actually, Felix, and your sense, not of the merits, but of the eventual impact. Where's this going to go?
It's going to go slowly, but you know who's there? Actually, I was just watching
Carney, I know.
A slideshow. John Carney is the face of Occupy Wall Street.
Go figure that out.
And he is going to lead them like Marianne, and they're going to topple all of the great institutions like Goldman Sachs, which is right now. Of course they're not. They're going to be hanging out until it just gets too cold, and there's going to be a lot of people hitching their flags to that movement because it is getting quite a lot of media play, especially from the unions are going to try and sort of jump in. I don't know where it's going to go, but I think that this is the first sign that we've seen that the left is just as angry as the right. And this is the sort of lefty version of the Tea Party.
Lee, what do you think?
Well, you know, I think it's unfortunate that the Occupy Wall Street whole movement, it's taken on, it's become very fringe and very perceived as very fringe. And I think that's unfortunate because I think there is a lot of anger in this country, and I think a lot of it is completely justified. You know, the middle class is getting squeezed. Wages are stagnant. There is a lot to be angry about. But I think it has become almost cartoonish, and that is going to serve it not well.
And yet, Felix, Washington goes blithely onward, as Stan and I were just talking about. Do you agree that we're basically stuck for a year until the election?
I think we're stuck well past the election, as you were pointing out. There's no real chance that anything substantive is going to change to make Washington start getting over its partisan bickering and doing something important. So, yeah, we're not going to get anything done before the election, and we're not going to get anything done after the election either. And we need to do something urgently because we have an unemployment rate of 9.1%. So it's a very bad situation. Yeah,
it just feels, Lee, like people have said, okay, 9.1%, that's the new normal.
Yes, it does, very much so. And I mean, you know, the numbers today were upbeat, I guess. Yeah. They were in that they were not a disaster. But right. I mean, if we've learned anything, it's that you can't take 1 month's numbers for anything, unfortunately, especially when it's a little bit positive.
right, exactly. And, you know, it's crazy. 100,000 jobs is nice, but it is just a little bit positive. Felix, let me switch gears for a minute and get us back to Monday. Maybe it was Tuesday, I forget. And the story out of Europe about Dexia, the Belgian bank to which a lot of American states and municipalities are exposed. Have we now found the place where people can say, oh, yeah, this is why it matters in the United States?
No, not really. I mean, Dexia has, when you say they're exposed, Dexia has lent money to American municipalities. But they don't, if Dexia goes bust, that doesn't harm the municipalities until they have to refinance. And somehow, I think America's municipalities are going to be able to refinance. So much as I would love this to be a wake-up call to the U.S., Europe is going to have to seriously implode before the markets here or anyone in America really pays much attention, I think.
Lee, you got to tell me that's not true.
Well, I think that you're...
Oh, okay.
No, here's the thing. I mean, few people in the U.S. have heard of Dexia, so I don't think that's going
to
do it.
Well, everybody who listens to the Marketplace has. Good. But anyway.
That's true. But I think that Europe needs to also step up and try to solve this problem itself. I mean, the liquidity facility they have is not enough. Hopefully they'll increase it. I mean, serious steps need to be taken. Or else this is going to boil over, right. And then we'll all know.
And then we'll all know. That's right. Lee Gallagher from Fortune Magazine, Felix Salmon from Reuters. Sorry, guys. Have a nice weekend.
You too, Kay.
Coming up, 21 Jump Street, Married with Children, Cops.
I don't think it's the daring network it once was. I think it's made its mark on television.
That'll be Fox. It turns 25 this weekend. But first, let's do the numbers. So this happened. Spain and Italy were downgraded. That halted a 3-day rally on Wall Street, despite the somewhat encouraging jobs report here in the States. The Dow Industrials fell 20 points, about a 10%, closed at 11,103. The NASDAQ off 27 points, 1.1%, 2479. The S&P 500 took off 9 points, 0.8%, ended things at 1155. For the week, the Dow rose 1.7%. The NASDAQ powered up 2.6%. The S&P 500 climbed 2.1%. Bad day, though, for financials. Bank of America and Morgan Stanley each cashed out 6%. Citigroup and JPMorgan Chase lost more than 5%. Wells Fargo unloaded 3.25%. Today, Sony disconnected 4.5%. It's expected to buy out Ericsson's stake in a decade-old mobile phone venture. Walmart lifted nearly 2%. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.07%. First time it's been above 2 in a while, I think. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace covers the world of economics. Are you ready for some Freakonomics? We're partnering with the team that writes about the hidden side of everything for a regular Marketplace Freakonomics story, podcast, and more. Just go to FreakonomicsRadio.com.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Monday. The winner of the Nobel Prize in Economics is announced in Stockholm, Sweden. In Houston, National Football League Commissioner Roger Goodell meets with team owners to discuss the addition of more overseas games next season. And run your errands now. The post office and banks will be closed for Columbus Day. I'm Desiree Peña.
This is Marketplace from APM American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. All right, so I'd be lying if I said I was eager to get to this next item, but I need to talk about our coverage of Steve Jobs yesterday. We didn't quite do what we set out to do, add a little context and a little value to the big news story of the day. And in the process of not doing that, we simply got some things wrong. So we got John Moe, the host of the Marketplace Tech Report, on the phone to help us fact-check ourselves a little bit. Hey, John.
Hey, Kai.
So as painful as this is, John, we got some things wrong yesterday. We said, for starters, PC files aren't going to open on a Mac.
Which is not true. They should open just fine. If you write something in Word on your PC, but you don't have Word on your Mac, the Mac will find some analogous program to open it with most of the time. Your common business and personal applications generally have some corresponding program that will at least let you see it, at least let you open the document to take a look at it. Apple's pretty good about that.
What about that bit where we said old Macs don't work with new iPods and old iPods don't necessarily work with new Macs?
Personal experiences may vary. Maybe you've got a loose wire or some weird virus that could cause trouble. But in general, you should have a fairly easy time of it if you have a Mac made any time after about 2003, which will let you install the latest update of iTunes, and then you should be good to go. Now, the new update to Apple's mobile operating system comes out on Wednesday. You'll need to update that through the computer, but after that, you'll get wireless syncing on your iPhone.
All right, so this is actually the big one. We tried yesterday to be clever with a story that people really have strong feelings about.
It probably struck a nerve because what Apple fans like about the products is that they think that they're easy to use and that they last. And the Marketplace story said just the opposite, and I think it made a lot of people upset.
John Moe, he hosts the Marketplace Tech Report. John, thanks a lot.
Thanks, Kai.
Today's industry and corporate story, there are big changes coming to the medical marijuana business. Federal prosecutors here in California announced a change in policy today, plans to target the storefront distribution of medical marijuana. Landlords, it turns out, who rent to pot dispensaries have been getting letters threatening criminal charges if they don't shut down within weeks. Jennifer Collins reports now from a city that had, at one point, more than 600 marijuana dispensaries right here in Los Angeles.
Medical marijuana is a billion-dollar business in California. 15 other states allow it. Beau Kilmer with the RAND Corporation says there's a problem with that.
Even though in those states it's legal to possess it for medicinal purposes, it's still prohibited by federal law.
And today, federal prosecutors in California announced a crackdown on dozens of storefront dispensaries. Mark Kleiman is a public policy professor at UCLA.
I think they've decided that having a billion-dollar illegal industry flourishing in public is sort of bad for business.
Medical marijuana brings in over $100 million in taxes for California. Steve D'Angelo directs one of the largest dispensaries here, Harborside Health Center in Oakland.
All of that tax revenue will disappear if the federal government is successful in this effort to close down regulated access.
And it may prompt something else, says Keith Robinson. I found him ringing the bell of Hollywood Haze on Sunset Boulevard.
Are you a customer?
Robinson says if the feds truly crack down, he'll find another supplier.
It's not going nowhere. It won't change nothing. You close a couple of stores, you can always go into your ghetto hood and get weed.
Or, says public policy professor Mark Kleiman, more likely it'll cause the dispensaries to reorganize and offer home delivery services.
It'll be like pizza.
I'm Jennifer Collins for Marketplace.
There's a page in the jobs report that came out this morning titled Employment by Veteran Status and Period of Service. And if you run your finger down to the line for Iraq and Afghanistan vets, you see their unemployment rate is 11.7%, a good 2.5 points higher than the national average, and probably headed higher, because more than 1 million people are expected to leave the military over the next 5 years as Iraq and Afghanistan wind down. So a lot of veterans are trying to figure out whether the experiences they had at war translate into marketable skills. From WPLN in Nashville, Blake Farmer reports.
Military installations from California to North Carolina have held job fairs in the last month, and thousands of veterans turn out.
Thank you. Good luck to you today.
Recently, the line to get into a job fair at Fort Campbell in Kentucky stretched well into the parking lot.
We'll get you guys in the building in a little bit, okay?
Harold Riggins runs the job placement office at Fort Campbell. He says keeping veterans out of the unemployment line is a growing challenge. For a long time, they didn't have to look far for work. The Department of Defense is the largest employer of military vets. But just as troop numbers are shrinking, Riggins says so is the Defense Department's civilian workforce.
I would tell you that there are lieutenant colonels that are having a hard time finding a job.
In the Fort Campbell Community Center, hundreds are milling around booths set up by dozens of employers. Staff Sergeant Leroy Camacho spent 12 years and 4 deployments as a combat engineer, using explosives to clear the way for troops or make life harder on the enemy. His expertise has limited civilian applications.
They have, you know, quarry blasting, you know, dynamite and stuff like that, but, you know, you have to go out in remote areas, and that just, you know, that's not something I really want to get into.
Camacho figures he'll need new skills, and he's leaning toward cars. A representative from a technical school revs a hot rod outside. Camacho wants to attend one of its programs so he can work at a BMW dealership.
It's not like the cars are going to, you know, explode on me or do something crazy like what I've been dealing with.
Combat veterans like Camacho have been dealing with a lot of death and destruction. And Harold Riggins says that makes some employers wary of hiring them.
Are they going to be a hazard? You know, if we have an issue in our organization, are they going to go postal?
Those questions about post-traumatic stress are overblown, he says, adding that combat experience can be a plus.
You tell a veteran to go out and dig a ditch with a spoon, they're going to figure out how to do it.
Have you done MIG welding before?
Lindsay Johnston is handing out brochures left and right. Her company builds tractor-trailer suspensions at a nearby plant. She's hired 6 vets as of June.
There's more discipline. There's more of a need and a want to be on time and show up to work, which you don't get a lot of times.
And many already have marketable skills like welding or logistics planning. So Johnston's question to soldiers like Specialist Jessica Maxwell is, when can you start?
April. Oh, okay, so pretty soon.
For the last 4 years, Maxwell has worked as a mechanic on Army trucks. The experience fits neatly on a resume.
It basically breaks it down into civilian terms, like replaces engine components such as fuel pumps, generators, starters, voltage regulators.
Maxwell says now she'll just have to learn her way around a highway truck instead of a Humvee. At Fort Campbell, Kentucky, I'm Blake Farmer for Marketplace.
When you talk about network television, non-cable network television, that is, you're talking about ABC, NBC, CBS, and Fox. Back in the 80s, there were only the big three. Fox didn't get its start until October of 1986, 25 years ago this weekend, as it happens. And as Marketplace's Adrian Hill reports, it has been quite a quarter century.
Fox's first broadcast was a late-night talk show hosted by Joan Rivers. And from the start, the network wanted everyone to know it wasn't going to play like the other guys.
You all know what a bleep is. This is the bleep button. We are going to be live, and that means no bleeps.
Jonathan Taplin is a media professor at USC.
They were trying to do something that was a little irreverent.
And Fox succeeded with shows like Married with Children.
Do you two have any kids?
2.
Where are they?
I don't know.
The Simpsons.
Dope!
Bad boys, what you gonna do?
And Cops, one of the earliest reality shows. 24 seasons in, you're not tired of the song yet?
No, not at all, not at all.
John Langley created Cops.
They were taking chances, they were taking risks, so they bought Cops.
Over the decades, he says, things have changed at Fox.
I don't think it's the daring network it once was. I think that it's, but I think it's made its mark on television.
Fox loosened TV up. Now it pulls in the most younger viewers, and it's had huge hits with shows like American Idol and Glee. But Langley isn't optimistic about what comes next.
You know, I think, in all honesty, that network television is sort of like a dead man walking. It's a corpse and doesn't know it.
The future, he says, is smaller, specialized audiences. In other words, cable. I'm Adrienne Hill for Marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, so as we began with today, we added jobs in September, but we are losing something else in this economy, homeowners. The Census Bureau said earlier this week that a hair over 65% of Americans owned their own homes in 2010. That is, to be sure, a substantial majority, but well below the 70% who owned at the housing bubble 5 years ago. Economists say it's unlikely we're going to get back to that level again. There are, though, other economists who say that's not a bad thing. All right, on a Friday, that's Marketplace from APM, American Public Media. Today, the Dow fell 20 points, about 0.2%. The NASDAQ off 27 points, 1.1%. The S&P 500 took off 9 points. That's 0.8%. Our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Celeste Wesson. The executive producer of the program is Deborah Clark. J.J. Yore is the vice president and general manager. Coming up this weekend on our personal finance show, Marketplace Money, should you be lucky enough to still have a free checking account? Oh, get ready.
Now we're seeing it kind of go back to that status quo of most banks are either going to get you to meet certain conditions to get free checking, or they're going to be charging you a fee.
I'm Kai Rizdal. Do have yourself a good weekend. We will meet you back here on Monday. This is APM. That's American Public Media.